session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 13. Ted, also during this time, it's at the period, obviously, of the Battle of Britain, and how aware were you of the situation that was going on at that stage?
I don't think we were any more aware than the general public. After all, we were up in the northwest, and the Battle of Britain was largely confined to the southeast, and we hadn't had any knowledge of what had happened to the chaps who trained on Harvards and were going to Spitfires and Hurricanes. I think that the attitude, circumstances in the country were reflected in or through the civilian population probably more than through the service, because we were very, very keen at that time. We were interested in what we were doing. We felt as if we were coming up to the same kind of fervour, if you like, that we knew was happening in the fighter squadrons taking part in the Battle of Britain. So there began to be really an heroic reflection of what we were hoping to be in a lesser way, shall we say.
And what was the kind of reputation with the general public of the RAF at that time?
Oh, excellent. So, well, from my knowledge, everybody, I can't remember any dissentient voices at all. And of course, on leave, I was made a great fuss of, I suppose. Other airmen under training were also special cakes made and that sort of thing, you know.
Were you placed on standby or anything like that during that period, though, for
at the end of we're still in Sillip, aren't we, at the OTU? I haven't yet gone to the squadron. On September the 15th, which it occurred to me was 1 year to the day after I'd following mobilisation, had moved from Manchester down to the ITW in Cambridge. We were crewed for a number of Hudsons, and they were bombed up. There was an instructor as captain of the aircraft, and pilots under training, such as myself, would be second pilots, and then the rest of the crew, a navigator or the second pilot, would have to be doing the navigating, and the wireless operator, air gunner, was taken from amongst the other instructors, because at that time number one COTU was really nothing more than a conversion flight. The actual operational training unit wasn't working to its full effect until later. After I'd done my first tour, having come back to Sillip to start instructing, then crews were actually made up and would be sent out to squadrons whilst at Sillip. So it was very much a scratch crew that was bombed up and placed on immediate call during that night. We had no further information simply that as I was not, and others were not billeted on the station, we were up in the town, because it would take a little time for us to get down to the aircraft should there be a sudden call for some kind of support that we could give. We had to, those in my position, and most of us, that included the trainee pilots, had to try and sleep under the wing of the aircraft that night. And as dawn broke, of course, we didn't feel too good, but we were very pleased that nothing had happened up to that point. And then during the day, we were stood down and everything returned to as normal a situation as it could be. But we were very near the end of our course and left the OTU ready to go to squadrons within very few days after that.
How were you notified of your posting?
I don't honestly remember whether we were dealt with as a whole or individually. I would imagine that we were told to report to the crew room. Number of times this has happened, though, in the future, and does tend to impinge on trying to remember the first one. It would either be that we were in the crew room and allocated to the various squadrons, or we were told by possibly our instructors. I'm not sure. We didn't have any flag waving or march past or anything of that kind. We just packed our bags. Time was short, actually. There was a desperate need to get more pilots into squadrons, not just in coastal, but throughout the service, of course.
Where were you posted to?
Posted to a 220 squadron at Thornaby, which is an aerodrome used by number 608 squadron, which was the North Yorkshire Royal Auxiliary Air Force stationed before the war. That was a different reserve arrangement compared with the Volunteer Reserve. I've explained, I think, earlier how the Volunteer Reserve was organised. The Auxiliary Air Force and the squadrons, and there were several of them, I can think of 608, 609, 610, 612, were dotted around the country where it was hoped they would be able to maintain sufficient recruitment to actually maintain aircraft with a skeleton regular presence as needed, so there would be a regular chief engineer or a regular chief navigator. There'll be a flying inspector and so on. So that aerodrome had been in existence, I think, for about 1935 and catered for the whole area around there. I think it was quite well recruited. It was in Thornaby, the field itself was in the sandwiched in between the towns of Stockton-on-Tees and Middlesbrough and Thornaby Township itself. In fact, it wasn't long after the war that the aerodrome was built over by Thornaby town, and there was a memorial there. There were one or two memorials, and a statue of an airman in the town square, I think. I haven't been back, but for some time.
How was it equipped as a post-war station? Sorry, pre-war station. Was it an established station, as you say, because it had been used?
Oh yes.
So was it concrete runways or grass or that type of thing?
It was concrete by the time we got there. I don't know at what time, what period, either pre-war or war. I would imagine it would be. Well, it's difficult to say. It depends. I would think, in the matter of making concrete runways, there are certain considerations. Obviously, flying the lighter aircraft, usually fighters, such as the Hawker, Hind, and the Hart biplanes, and even the single engine monoplane. Fighters such as the Hurricane and, of course, a little later the Spitfire, would be quite happy carrying on landing on grass for a considerable time before that is if the station was going to continue in that present use. But where the aircraft were using an airfield either having or shortly intending to have heavier twin-engined aircraft, and we're talking about going up to the weight and size of the prototype bombers as they were at the time, Whitleys and Wellingtons and so on. Obviously, the need for concrete runways was immediate. So, without knowing the history of Thornaby Airfield, as to what kind of aircraft they were flying, I have an idea that they were pretty varied. But I think that would prompt the need for them to have runways if they were going to become a station, as indeed they did, for coastal aircraft. I mean, the one thing follows another. The idea of using coastal aircraft to obviate the need for a cruiser, a Royal Navy cruiser squadron to patrol the North Sea, would presumably be on the plans before war broke out. So if you're going to have aircraft to keep surveillance over the North Sea up to enemy coast, which of course is what happened, and had in that sense been very well planned, then there were these four airfields designated the coastal and up and down the east coast able to do that. So the one thing followed the other. Once they decided that you could do without the Navy cruiser squadron, and in any case it's very unlikely that the Navy at the beginning of the war could have spared them to do that, then you've got to think about the kind of runway that you need for the aircraft that you need to do the ultimate job.
And what had 220 Squadron been doing from the outbreak of war until the point that you joined them? What role had they undertaken?
They had been, as had the other Hudson squadrons, one can only say up to the time when I joined 220 that they've been working up to a full operational level, but that doesn't mean that they weren't able to take part, and I speak generally of the Hudson squadrons, Bertram Newton Northcotes in Lincolnshire, Thornaby, Lucas and Wick. Still operating Ansons in some squadrons, so a large part of their time was taken up in converting to Hudsons until perhaps the spring of 1940. I don't think any of the four or five squadrons would be fully dependent on Hudsons until that time. Some had them earlier than others. But as far as 220 were concerned, they had taken losses and carried out many offensive patrols over Dunkirk, as had other Hudson squadrons. One can imagine why and how the poor old chaps who were retreating from Dunkirk complained from time to time they never saw RAF aircraft, and they were actually working to try and protect those who had been managed to be got off the Dunkirk shore. And from time to time attacking German land forces. So that was a large part of their work. 220 Squadron was tasked with, and other squadrons had been, tasked with trying to find the Altmark, the German ship which was holding a lot of Navy and Merchant Marine crews, having been used as a dump ship, as it were, by the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, the two German very large battle cruisers, which had sunk 150,000 tons, I think it was, shipping before they retired into Brest. And it was an aircraft of 220 Squadron which discovered the Altmark. Quite a lot of reconnaissance had been done to that purpose in the field in Norway, and they were able to be relieved by the Royal Navy. 269 Squadron had, even with their Ansons, had taken part in protecting as best they could the forces employed at Narvik in the spring of 1940. They'd also had some rather tough assignments to attack bridges, and I forget the name of any particular one, but that was the sort of thing that they were doing. 220 also were trying out a new bomb sight and happened to sink from 8,000 feet, which seemed to be unnecessary height so far as we were concerned. A German merchant ship, can't think of the name of it, but they were all quite busy doing that kind of work.
So am I right in thinking the roles then were one of, when you joined, would have been one of general reconnaissance, patrolling, anti-submarine work, that sort of thing?
220 weren't much involved in anti-submarine work as such, not in the way we came to be trained to it and first experienced it later flying from Wick. The U-boat Minnis grew more quickly, I think, than was expected, but so that by the time of March or April 1941, excuse me, it became one of the more important targets for Coastal Command. 220, when I joined, was mainly engaged in what we called security area patrols, which were flown by two or three single aircraft singly spread over areas of the North Sea, so that we had an SA-3 patrol. It was called leaving from Flamborough Head, going across to the coast, the enemy coast. I forget the actual direction, but it would be at about 125 or something like that. And we flew out on a certain course, and there were parallel tracks being flown by other aircraft from the other Hudson squadrons, so that the end of the appointed turning point at the end of the first leg, we turned north for a certain distance, about 20 miles I think, on a heading, and then flew the reciprocal back to the starting point. And because of the angle that they were all parallel, all the courses that were flown, it meant that if a ship was missed coming across the North Sea towards the UK, if it was missed at one point, because it had to cross the tracks of other aircraft, it would be seen at some point. At least it was pretty certain that it would be.
So, as you say, that was taking over really the role that in the First World War, say, the Royal Navy had done in the North Sea.
Yes.
You were becoming the eyes, really, of really the Royal Navy and the RAF.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How?
And of course, I'm sorry. The determination of the RAF not to show any detrimental effects from the whenever the going wasn't very good. Was shown, I think, in the decision to send out what we call battle flights of three aircraft formating, and this was to check the shipping if there was any, or to employ the best defensive methods we could. By flying out from Thornaby, and there were other departure points as well for the other squadrons, across to Horn's Reef, which is about a third of the way down the Danish coast from the north, across the Skagerrak to Lister Point, where there is a lighthouse. I was at the time, and then the return leg from there. It's a sort of triangle. Really, it was just an aggressive sort of showing off, if you like, that if we'd met an equal force of German ME-109s, I don't think many of us would have returned, but sometime, if that did happen, then you would break up and carry on singly and get down on the deck as quickly as you could and really built it for home.
So do I get this right in the sense that it was to dominate the North Sea, in a sense? Was it to show that it was an area of...
I don't know whether we did dominate it or not, but that was... It gave us the feeling that it was as much our water as it was theirs, anyway.
If we can take you a little bit back before you started patrolling, what had occurred when you'd arrived there, and what were your kind of initial duties when you arrive on an operational squadron?
We'd only really heard about what wireless operators and gunners do. Actually fired a Browning gun at EFTS, actually, at Faroes. But that's as far as it went. I think we probably learned more when we were billeted in this hydro hotel in Silloth with these chaps who were going to join 608 Squadron, than we were likely to know up to this point of joining the squadron, because this was the first time we had met for a practical purpose a wireless operator and a gunner who was going to be on our crew. We were flying as two pilots because at that time, I understand, and this may be true, it may not, but I don't think there were all that many navigators as such in the RAF at the time. In Bomber Command, of course, even with aircraft of much the same size as ours, and they were still flying with two pilots. Mind you, it might have been more necessary with them than with us, because for a few months, if not years, certainly I think it was up to 1941 at the earliest, they didn't have automatic pilots in Bomber Command, Wellington or Whitworth. We did, of course. One pilot would be termed the captain of the aircraft, or the crew, and the other pilot would first of all start by navigating. The navigation that we were taught, that I was taught anyway, and it applied to my friend Henry, who was posted with me, and others, of course, were still using the methods of navigation which we were taught at flying training school, where we got our wings. I mean the service flying training school, not the elementary one. That was where we really learnt about navigation in its basics. The idea when Coastal Command expanded had been that there would be a special course, a navigation course established. I think it was at Thorny Island, somewhere down in that area. So that the pilots, each pilot, would be trained not only to fly the aircraft and the usual tactical necessities and the practical knowledge that would be needed to do that, but also to be able to navigate over water. It was quite a lengthy course. But of course, as soon as the squadron started to be expanded, that wasn't feasible. You couldn't wait for somebody to go through a 2-month or 3-month navigation course in order to make up a crew. When you realize that we had a certain knowledge which we could use. So it really was a matter of having first joined the squadron, you were still under training, it's something that is ongoing anyway. But it was a very happy way to learn about both jobs.